From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Gelton, and this is On Point. What a year, and what a year for books. Memoirs and tell-alls from last year's election, great books about great thinkers, men and women of history, Leonardo da Vinci, Ulysses Grant, Laura Ingalls Wilder, thoughtful examinations of race, the media, society. Critics and booksellers from across the country are with us to talk through, reflect on, and recommend their favorite reads of the year. This hour on Point, Best Books of 2017. You can join us on air or online. What books couldn't you put down in 2017? What captivated you, riveted you, spoke to you deeply? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And we have a trio of readers with us today whose job it is to think about this and who have been thinking about it. They've given us their top picks of the year. You can find those at our website, onpointradio.org. And while you're there, you can also find the On Point staff's picks as well. So joining me now from New York is Kevin Nguyen, senior editor for GQ, where he reviews books. Kevin Nguyen, welcome back to On Point.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tom.
And with us from Chicago is Elizabeth Taylor, who's co-editor of the National Book Review and literary editor-at-large for the Chicago Tribune and a board member and past president of the National Book Critics Circle. Elizabeth Taylor, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here, Tom.
And from Salt Lake City, Utah, is Betsy Burton, co-owner and co-founder of the King's English Bookshop, which was a finalist for Publishers Weekly's 2017 Bookstore of the Year. Congratulations for that, Betsy.
Thank you, Tom.
And Betsy's also the past president of the American Booksellers Association. So, Betsy, welcome to On Point. And here's my question. I've written a couple of books myself, and I think that what we authors wonder about is, are people still buying books, or has book reading fallen victim to the internet like so many other things have?
People are still buying books. In fact, you know, even e-books, which we felt were going to slowly take over, have plateaued and actually gone down, and print books are selling more than ever. And people are just as impassioned about the new books that they discover every year as they ever were.
Well, that's great news, isn't it? And I'm sure, I mean, especially to you as a bookseller, but it's, you know, to all of us, I think it's great news that people are still reading books.
And thinking, which is important right now.
So, Betsy, as a bookstore owner, and I guess your business is holding up. I mean, there have been sort of changes in the industry, but independent bookstores are doing quite well. I guess you have you must have sort of a loyal clientele. Is that right?
Well, we do. I mean, we've been very active in the local movement, and that has made a huge difference. But the other thing that's made a difference is that as Amazon has increased its market share, they've really hurt the chains much more than they have us. So that's been an odd circumstance in our favor, I suppose. Yep. But our business is up, and we're really having a kind of renaissance all across the country.
That's really terrific. And before we get into sort of like individual titles, are you seeing any trends in book buying over this year as compared to last year?
Yeah, I think last year people were nervous and they were sort of into escape. And although we do sell some escape, people are really buying tough books that deal with tough issues. It's as if suddenly they're determined to face the truth about this life we're all living. Mm. And they don't back away from the hard books, whether it be fiction or nonfiction. And that isn't always the case.
That's interesting. I want to go to you next, Kevin Nguyen, at senior editor for GQ, where you review books. One of the things we asked you to do is to pick out some of your favorite books from 2017. What was number one on your list, Kevin?
I got to say, number one by a large mile was White Tears by Hari Kunzru.
And tell us a little bit about that book.
Yeah, it's actually a deeply smart, very funny, occasionally very dark book. It kind of takes different shapes in weird ways. It starts out with two hipsters in Brooklyn who they're two white guys. They love black music. They're obsessed with it, and they don't really seem to reckon with what it means emotionally, historically. So kind of the first third of the book is, you know, almost a send-up of you know, their lack of knowledge of this history. And then middle section, it kind of becomes a thriller when something very dramatic happens. And then the last third just turns into a straight-up ghost story where these two characters have to reckon with America's past.
Do you have it there in front of you, Kevin?
I've got a little excerpt for you if you want to hear that.
Yeah, could you read that for us, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Carter taught me to worship. It's not too strong a word, what he worshipped. He listened exclusively to black music because, he said, it was more intense and authentic than anything made by white people. He spoke as if white people were the name of an army or a gang, some organization to which he didn't belong. I paid no mind to his garbled explanation for the source of this black intensity. The sound was good, and I'd noticed something extraordinary that was occupying most of my attention. I was listening to the songs that had been recorded 20 years before, and they had no ill effect on me. There was no backwards pull, no sensation of vertigo. I forgot what it was I'd been scared of. I let it all go. I could not remember the last time I had felt so happy and carefree.
Now, this is interesting. Cultural appropriation, Kevin, has been a big issue in sort of cultural and political circles. We have here a story of white boys writing about being interested in black music. Meanwhile, it's written by Hari Kunzru. Tell us who Hari Kunzru is.
Yeah, Hari, I think he's Indian, British, and he's just an extraordinary novelist. I think this is probably his fifth or sixth book. But he just, he writes brilliantly about music. He writes brilliantly, in fiction. Just even the passage I just read, there's so much going on there. At first we're kind of making fun of these two white boys, and then it immediately moves into like a real appreciation of the music. And that's kind of authentic too. So he kind of moves between genres really seamlessly. And the book is just a great genre mashup with just really smart ideas kind of underlying everything.
Let's go now to Elizabeth Taylor, who's co-editor, as I said, of the National Book Review and literary editor-at-large for the Chicago Tribune. Elizabeth, what was your top book of 2017?
Oh, it's so hard. It's like picking your favorite child.
Yeah.
But I like to – the books that I was really drawn to this year sort of spoke to me because they said something larger about what we were going through as a country. And one of the books I – respected so much and really learned so much from was The Evangelicals, The Struggle to Shape America by Frances Fitzgerald. It was an extraordinary book one that, as Betsy said, people are, drawn to challenging books, and this is worth it. It's really good.
Well, that, I cover religion at NPR,
yes.
Frances Fitzgerald was really prescient in spending as much time as she did writing about the evangelicals and having the book come out just at a time when, for, I guess, political reasons, but also cultural reasons, the sort of the evangelical segment of the community became of such interest to the broader public.
And it's extraordinary because she's been working on this book for so long.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like I just feel like the best writers have this sort of sixth sense that they can kind of anticipate what will be bubbling up in the culture. And, she was, before the nation had really heard of, Tammy Faye, the Bakers and all sorts of, the television evangelist, she was right there with Falwell writing for The New Yorker on them. So this is really a book that's, been a genesis for a long time.
And back to Betsy Burton. I guess there are a couple of ways to look at the, the best books question from the point of view of a bookseller. I mean, you are yourself an author and you are a reader, so I'm sure you have your own opinions, but you're also a bookseller. Can I ask you, what was your number one selling book in 2017?
Our number one selling book is This Immeasurable Place, Food and Farming on the Edge of Wilderness, which oddly enough is a cookbook. But if you know anything about Utah, as it's been in the news of late, it's that Trump has taken away half of the Grand Staircase National Monument and 80% of Bear's Ears, these two blissfully beautiful wilderness areas that had been protected, one by Clinton and one by Obama. And so these two women, Blake Spaulding and Jennifer Castle, own this wonderful restaurant, which is very well-known nationally, right on the edge of Grand Staircase. And it's a food, food to table, and has been since they opened it many years ago, one of the very first people to do that truly. And their first cookbook dealt with that subject, but this one deals with the wilderness of Grand Staircase National Monument. It's really a love letter to that wilderness. So, yes, there are wonderful recipes. There are wonderful pieces. There's wonderful writing. There's a poem by Mary Oliver that's one of my favorite of her poems. Bruce Babbitt wrote the foreword. There are quotes from everybody from Ed Abbey to E.B. White. Mm. It's just a lovely, lovely book, and it's also, I thought, a very stirring book about a problem that's going to get only worse because apparently President Trump plans to do this across the country, not just in Utah.
Yeah, we've actually discussed that on this very program previously. So, you know, we do this program at the end of the year because it is the end of the year and it's a time to look back on the best books of the year, but it's also a holiday time and it's a time when people are thinking about books to buy. You know, I don't imagine that, you know, the really kind of tough, depressing book about a critical issue is necessarily a great gift, but this sounds like this book that this part photography, part cookbook, part storybook, sounds like that might be actually a good gift book. Is that right, Betsy?
That's right, and I think it's why it's our single number one bestseller.
You've seen it.
It's just a perfect present.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to ask you to read from that was not necessarily your personal favorite. You've ranked some other books, although I do note it was in your top 10. What was your favorite book of the year, Betsy?
Sing and Baird Sing. I think that I loved all the books I brought, and I love fiction particularly, but I think this is one of those books that will last beyond probably all of us. I think it's a book that will go down as one of the great books of American literature.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton. We're looking back this hour at the best books of 2017. You can join the conversation. What books piqued your interest this year? Generated thoughtful discussion or sparked a spirited debate among family and friends? We've had a lot of debate this year among family and friends. Follow us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And we're talking this hour with Betsy Burton. She is the co-owner and co-founder of the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. Also, Elizabeth Taylor, co-editor of the National Book Review and literary editor-at-large for the Chicago Tribune, and Kevin Nguyen, senior editor for GQ, where he reviews books. And Betsy, just before the break, you were telling us that your personal favorite book from this year was Sing Unburied Sing. And this is actually a book that has gotten quite a bit of attention. I know that Elizabeth put it on her top 10 list as well. I'm wondering if you have that book in front of you, Betsy, would you be mm-hmm. able to read a little selection of it that you think brings out sort of the best of the book and the best of the book's writing?
Sure. I think if you don't mind a little bit of background,
yeah.
It is, in fact, a road trip going up to this infamous prison. And there's a strong narrative, but there are two children in this book, Jojo, and he's 13, and his little sister, Kayla, who they are so moving. Their relationship is so moving and so not sappy. It's just an amazing thing. And part of the reason they're so close is that their mother is abusive. And the difference between this book and showing abuse and other books is that you're seeing and hearing that abuse and what propels it from the inside. There are three voices in the book. One is a ghost. There are lots of ghosts this year. One is Jojo, the 13-year-old boy, and the other is the mother. And so what I'm going to read you, just to set it up, they're on their way back from this road trip. They've picked up her husband, who was in this horrible prison.
He's just been
and
released.
They stopped at somebody's house, and they've thrown their clothes in the wash, and she's put them in the tub, and now she's dried off her daughter, and she's had this impulse already to slap her, and she hasn't because Jojo's watching. And where we're about to start, she's now looking at him, and she's already thinking to herself, you know, he's got this little tubby piece around his waist because he's an adolescent. She says, Make sure you get them roles, I say. Jojo flinches like I've hit him. Shies closer to the mirror. It feels good to be mean, to speak past the baby I can't hit and let that anger touch another. The one I'm never good enough for, never mama for, just Leonie, a name wrapped around the same disappointed syllables I've heard from mama, from pop, even from given my whole life. I dump Michaela, the wailing bundle, on the bed and begin toweling her off, and she's still kicking and screaming and moaning and now saying, Jojo, and I just want to give her one slap or maybe two, enough to sting her good, but I don't know if I'll be able to stop. St. Teresa, I won't be able to stop. Help me. I leave her trembling and walk to the door and yell at the bathroom at Jojo, who stands with his hands tucked in his armpits, his arms like football pads across his chest, and watches us. Get her dressed. Put her to sleep for a nap. Don't leave this room. I slam the door.
Well, that's really powerful writing. And
it is. She's incredible.
She's a great writer. Great writer. Now, one of the things that is suggested to me here is that, you know, abusive parents, abusive mothers are something that's hard to feel any sympathy for. And yet it sounds from what you're describing that this, you know, we maybe sort of get inside the sort of the emotions or the person of someone who does abuse their children and feels terrible
about
it.
You absolutely do. You do start to understand her from the inside. You see the things that have moved her to be where she is now. And also there's this thing about parenting where even the best of us, there are times when our kids so frustrate us. We may not think of hitting them, but certainly we think of yelling, maybe do yell. And you realize how narrow that chasm is between those of us who restrain ourselves and those who don't.
Yeah. Let's consider some other titles now that made your all's top 10 list. Back to you, Kevin Nguyen. You read earlier from White Tears, by Hari Kunzu. And what are your other, let's say, your other top, the other top two books besides White Tears that are on your list?
Yeah, a couple more books. I think this one is an extremely giftable book for the holidays. Mrs. Fletcher by Tom Parada. Just an absolutely the funniest book I read this year. Just a total send-up of modern sexuality. Basically, it sort of takes the form of two parallel narratives. There's Eve Fletcher. She's a single mom. She's about to be an empty nester. And her son, who goes off to college, and her son's kind of you know, your typical high school jock. And he thinks he's going to go to college. He's going to have a lot of sex, you know, just make it out that way. And it turns out to be a totally different experience for him. And then the flip side, his mom starts taking all these community college classes about sexuality, and she kind of has her own awakening. So their lives kind of go in two separate directions, and just the gap between it is just very funny.
Well, to be able to, I mean, I guess for a lot of people find sex stories funny, but I think that it sounds to me like the combination of the mother sort of rediscovering her sexuality and then the boy having this sex college experience is sort of unusual, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's funny too, because from the mother's perspective, it's told in third person, so you get like a little bit of distance. And then for the son, it's told in first person. And there's just a lot of him having these insecurities in his head that he didn't think he would have going into college.
And number three on your list, Kevin?
Yeah, Ghosts of the Tsunami by Richard Lloyd Perry. Perry wrote probably my favorite true crime book of the past decade, The People Who Eat Darkness, which was about a British woman that was murdered in Japan. And I won't spoil anything, but that story is completely wild. This one is not true crime. It's actually a lot sadder. It's about the tsunami in 2011, you know, just the biggest natural or the biggest disaster in terms of life taking since the bombing of Nagasaki. So Perry, you know, he goes to this small town of Okawa, and, you know, he just talks to the people there. He talks about the people who lost their lives and the people that survived. And the whole thing is just immaculately reported.
And we're going to go to you next, Elizabeth, for some more of your favorites. But first, let's hear from a couple of listeners who are calling in with their own favorite books of the year. First, we have Beth. She's calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Hello, Beth. Thanks for calling On Point.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call. I don't know how this is going to make me sound to others, but I am a historian by training. And so when we have times that I would consider of national or international crisis or turmoil, I find that looking back, going back to history really helps me feel better, especially books that kind of take a long perspective on how things come full circle and ebb and flow, and people are horrible to each other, and then they're better to each other, and then the cycle kind of continues. And so the book that I wanted to mention was Stephen Greenblatt's Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve, which I found fascinating. It's really a story of how the Adam and Eve story has been used across cultures and across time, and how it's been viewed, including to oppress others, particularly people in colonized lands, and just the way that our origin story for so many of us in the Judeo-Christian tradition has been used for good and for evil. So that was fascinating. He's a wonderful writer. His prose is beautiful, but also the subject matter. So I find going back to history very comforting in times like this. So.
Well, thank you very much for that suggestion. That does sound indeed like a fascinating book. And how about one more suggestion? This one from Mark, who's calling from Danville, Kentucky. Mark, thanks for calling On Point. And what's your favorite book of the year?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Kind of in vain with your last call in, the book that I would like to recommend is The Storm Before the Storm by Mike Duncan. It's a history of the kind of the fall of the Republic of Rome. He goes into pretty good detail about how social norms and political precedents were kind of upended, and kind of talks about how the Senate lost some power as the executive branch started to gain more. And I just thought, you know, kind of considering the time that we're in right now, some people might want to think about where the state of the United States is if they try to compare us to Rome. And it does a fairly interesting job of that history. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of frightening to think that our history is being compared to the fall of Rome. But that sounds like a really fascinating thing. Thank you so much, Mark. We'd like to hear from more of you. Remember, our phone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To you, Elizabeth, I'm sure you're taking close notes of what our listeners, what's catching their attention. You probably are familiar with the books they're talking about, but you talked before in the first segment that your number one book was The Evangelicals by Francis Fitzgerald. What are your number two and number three books?
Well, I have a few books. Because the Life and Times of Michael A. and Lincoln and the Bardo, a novel. George Saunders just won the Booker Prize. They're both terrific. And I would add for the last caller just two books that speak to those. They're sort of the history of fake news. One is The Fantasyland by Kurt Anderson, and the other one is Bunk by Kevin Young. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested in sort of the long history of how, as Fantasyland, how America went haywire, 500-year history, those will do it for you.
Elizabeth, can you talk a little bit about Lincoln and the Bardo? I was reading, you know, about this earlier, and it sounds like a fascinating story. Can you tell us about that book?
It is fascinating, and it's so many of the books, I think much of literature right now is sort of transcending genre. They're sort of pulling from history and fusing, you know, sort of supernatural qualities. And I think Bardo, Lincoln the Bardo does that. I had not heard of the Bardo, but it is a key concept of Tibetan Buddhism. It's sort of the spiritual landscape between physical sort of life and death. And George Saunders is a phenomenal short story writer, but this is really his first novel. And Lincoln, the title, 16th president, and it's sort of, he's in despair. It's 1962, and his beloved son, Willie, who's 11, has died of typhoid. He's in the White House. And so he sort of goes to, he's visited in another world by his father. So it sort of takes place in this spiritual landscape at the cemetery. But it's stylistically and it's very interesting. It's built as sort of a collage of voices. They sort of overlap and argue. And some of the parts of the book are almost like they're ripped from old diaries from the 1860s, from real characters, and then some are made up. And so, and he fuses them together in this really artful way, and it gets you in touch with the sort of the chorus of life. It's an extraordinary novel.
And you know what I'm thinking, Elizabeth, as you talk about this book, is how many books there have been written, nonfiction books written about Abraham Lincoln. I would think it's kind of a bold act for a fiction writer to take on Abraham Lincoln as a character.
Absolutely. It's sort of and there are so many great histories, and they're actually, you know, some sort of novels that use Lincoln. This is a really bold, and it's just so inventive, and it's a whole cast of characters, and it's sort of, you know, it's also, it's more than anything, this book is just a call for empathy, because you have Lincoln at this horrible point in the Civil War, and you can see sort of how he hears from the dead, and there's some very funny parts as these sort of people talk to him, these crazy characters, but it's really, it's about sort of suspending disbelief and sort of listening to everyone. I mean, it's a really powerful book.
That's Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders. Let's go now to Mike from Saunderstown, Rhode Island. Mike, do you have a favorite book that you've come across this year?
Hi, Tom. I have a book by Natalie Kosar called Pattern Behavior. And what it does is it takes she takes patterns, like clothing patterns, and the models on clothing patterns, which are animated models, and kind of funny. And then she dubs them with all sorts of, this lightens things up. This is a comedy book. It's a lot of fun, but it has some poignant political and social commentary throughout. Really neat, really fun book, and it has a lot of relevance, even though it's very short and easy to read.
Well, I know a lot of listeners repeat books that are short and easy to read. Every year we get a number of these doorstoppers, these famous doorstopper biographies in particular. So thanks for that, Mike. A couple of other suggestions from people who are weighing in via Twitter. Media Codex, that's a handle for this listener, recommends The Sellout by Paul Betty. Nothing came even close, Media Codex says. And a comment from our website from G. Welch recommending Code Girls by Liza Mundy, detailing the World War II efforts of young, talented women who cracked Axis codes and ciphers and were critical in winning the war. Those sound like great books as well. Kevin, let's go back to you for your number three book on your top 10 list. Tell us about that.
Exit West by Mohsin Hamid. Just a tremendous book. It's basically a book about emigration, and it's about this young couple. And the story is kind of told in this sort of fabulistic, lyrical kind of style. So the country that they're originally from is unclear, but you imagine it's something like Syria. And the couple discovers these magical doorways that kind of allow them to leave the country and move to a different country. So really what it is it's an immigration story that where the difficulty isn't the movement, but it's actually in like getting to a place. It's a difficult a novel about the difficulty of place. And, you know, a lot of people are talking about how, oh, there's so many, you know, relevant novels. And just the way, like, the publishing cycle works, you know, these things have been written 1-2 years ahead of time. So in a lot of ways, fiction is actually further ahead than we can even imagine.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton. We're looking back at 2017's literary landscape, what we loved, what you loved, why they were so special. You can join the conversation. Were you reading fiction this year, nonfiction, biographies? Follow us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And we've been joined by Elizabeth Taylor, co-editor of the National Book Review and literary editor-at-large for the Chicago Tribune. Also, Kevin Nguyen, senior editor for GQ, where he reviews books. And Betsy Burton, co-owner and co-founder of the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. And first, Elizabeth Taylor, you talked earlier about your number one book, which was The Evangelicals. We've also talked about Lincoln and the Bardo. The third, I have your top 10 list here, and the third on your list is Cuz, The Life and Times of Michael A. Tell us a little bit about that book, and maybe I can get you to read something from it as well.
Sure. It's a wonderful book, and it's not a long book. It's and it's very powerful. It's sort of a blend of sort of a family memoir, philosophy, and also a sort of very fierce indictment of the mass incarceration crisis in America. It's the story, and if anyone likes these sort of separated at birth stories, like the other Westmore, you know, think of that. This is the story of Danielle Allen, a prominent Harvard professor, high achieving, has been a MacArthur Genius Fellow, and then her cousin, and it's spelled C-U-Z, Cuz. And it's about her younger cousin who's murdered at the age of 29. He sort of gets into petty crime at a young age, you know, just like little things. And then he's convicted of a felony at 15. And then he is sent, rather than, you know, to a juvenile facility, punished as an adult. So it's a critique of this detention centers, adult prisons. And she, when he gets out, after 11 years, she tries to help him sort of be successful with a job search and rental housing, going to college. But there's just this undertow that was just so intense.
And do you have a section from it that you can
sure.
read?
Sure. I've just this beginning.
Okay.
It's called Garden Party. Danielle, phone call for you. It's your dad. I broke away from conversation with my husband's cousins. From glancing, distracted talk about the kids who were playing yards away in their floral sundresses under a soft English garden party sun. Rising from the picnic table, I took the cell phone from him and walked a few steps. Hi, Dad. Danielle, it's Michael. My father's voice, the careful, clipped speech of a retired professor, came from across the Atlantic, from Maryland through the ether, but sounding as if it were miles beneath the seas, crackling, wispy, as though the first ever transatlantic cables. He's dead. What? Dead. They found him shot in a car. What? Dead. I'm coming. Michael. My cousin. My baby cuz. Sometimes on English mornings, a gazy haze clings in the air. This, though, was July, and now afternoon, but that same sort of whiteness suddenly seemed to wrap the sky and the surrounding willows, and I near collapsed, staggering into my husband's arms and said, Jim, we have to go. What? Michael's dead. What? Dead, we have to go. Straight away we go. We had to go to South Central. And so we left.
Wow. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth.
Yeah.
Kevin Nguyen, I'm looking at the top 10 book lists of all three of you, and I see one book that appears very prominently on all three lists, and that is...
Should we guess what it is?
Guess what it is.
We all know.
Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yes.
Yeah. Called it. Nailed it.
Okay. Tell us about it.
Killers of the Flower Moon, David Grand, New Yorker staffer, he just goes real deep in the story about the Osage people, and, you know, it's in the early 20s, and, you know, just through the discovery of oil under this land, they become the richest people per capita in the world. So they have this sudden wealth, and you know, one by one, they're almost systematically and suspiciously all found dead. And so, of course, there's a conspiracy behind this, and David Grand is kind of unraveling this. And there's a lot here about race and class. But I think the other really interesting parallel story here is it also marks the rise of the FBI. And so, you know, it's J. Edgar Hoover's kind of like government body that he uses as muscle. And so it's got this parallel rise to very dark places in American history.
Well, the fact that it appears on all three of your top 10 lists, given the hundreds and hundreds of books that come out every year, is certainly just by itself a pretty remarkable statement. Let's go now to Megan, who is on the line from Augusta, Maine. Megan has been listening to this program and has her own list of favorite books. Megan, thanks for calling On Point.
Hey, Tom.
And what's on your list,
Megan? I have four books.
Okay. Quickly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. This year kind of seemed to radiate heavy realism that has a lot of humanity. So the first one was Walk Away by Cory Doctorow. He seems to like predict the future with his fiction, and there's a lot of humanity in it. And then The Child Finder by Renee Denfield. And that I thought was just going to be a quick mystery, but it totally had absolute beauty that was pulled from a dark place.
Mm-hmm.
Sing Unburied Sing, I'll second that. And the other one is No One Cares About Crazy People by Ron Powers, which didn't get an awful lot of press, but it's a historian that's writing about his son who has schizophrenia and just uses all his powers as a historian to write this amazing book about mental health care. And it's very beautiful. And if I could give a quick shout out to The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas, too. That's a teen book, and that was really great, too.
Well, Megan, it sounds like the fact that you can reel off those five books, not all of which are, you know, well-known, shows to me that you are a pretty avid reader. Is that the way you describe yourself?
Yeah, I work at a bookstore.
All right. Well, so you and Betsy have that in common. Betsy, let's see. I'm looking at your back at your list. So is there another book you want to highlight,
among your
favorites? Go ahead.
There's one I actually moved up. It was near the bottom, but as a bookseller, this is a book that I found this last couple of weeks. If you put this book in somebody's hand, they look at it, they fall in love with it almost immediately, almost because of the physical nature of the book, and then realizing what it's about, and then they buy five for presents. It's called Silence in the Age of Noise. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce the author. It's Erling Kagan, perhaps. He's Norwegian. He's an explorer, and he's walked across both poles and up Everest, and then walked across the South Pole again because he became interested in discovering more about silence and what it means and what it could do in our lives. And I want to say at the outset, I don't like self-help and simplistic books at all. This isn't one of those. This is just a real meditation on what silence means and what it could do to change us. The book itself is beautiful. The cover is sort of lavender fading into salmon. It's a dawn sky. There are little pictures throughout, not too many, but they are that same simple. They have that same simple look, and it's a small book. And it deals with silence in a very interesting way. And there are no neat tricks to discover silence. I don't know if we have time to do a little reading, but I have one that I think encapsulates it.
I think we have to get a couple more callers in. But
Okay.
But it sounds to me, Betsy, that that might be actually a good gift book.
It is kind of, along with the big, this immeasurable place, this is a small gift book that is really right for almost anybody. Our lives are so fragmented right now between politics and technology and everything else that tears us apart. This book can kind of mend us.
That's Silence in the Age of Noise. And I know from my own Norwegian relatives that the author is Erling Kagge. So there you go. Let's go now to Barbara, who is on the line from Waycross, Georgia. And Barbara, thanks for calling On Point. Do you have a favorite of the year?
Hi, Tom. I do. One of our finest contemporary novelists is Christina Baker Klein,
And her A Piece of the World is, I think, a really important piece of Americana that combines both literature and art. It features Andrew Wyeth's painting, Christina's World, and it really does a nice job of characterizing Christina, the figure in the painting, and her story and her development, sort of in the vein of Tracy Chevalier and others who've taken a piece of art and encapsulated a story, or the story behind that piece of art.
Do you work in a bookstore, Barbara? How did you come across that book?
Well, I'm a retired English teacher, so I'm constantly seeking reading material. I'm also part of a very active book club here in Waycross.
Good. I'm glad to. I'm a big supporter of book clubs. Let's go now to Gail, who's on the line from Fish Creek, Wisconsin. Gail, thanks for calling On Point. What's your favorite book of the year?
Oh, my favorite book is The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia, by Masha Gessen. It's just fascinating to read. She writes this book. She's had others that are just she's just a phenomenal writer. The detail that she comes into and the depth of how she writes, it just creates such a story for you in beyond what it is that she's actually writing about. You get this depth to every character, to every situation that she shares in the book. And this one is just every page is just amazing. It makes you really think about a lot of other things because and relatedly, what I'm finding is how a lot of what is happening and was going on in Russia, I see flavors of that actually starting to happen in the U.S. with the limitations of freedom and the consolidations of the marketplace and taking yeah. over of media and the fights for the internet that are going on now. I really recommend this book to so many people because it just starts to get you to think, which is the biggest freedom that we have. Yeah. And I think we're all starting to start to lose that and have it taken from us with the restrictions going on in information and education. Right. It's just a phenomenal book. She's an amazing writer.
That is The Future is History by Masha Gessen. And as you say, it sounds really relevant right now in particular. And we have gone through a lot of books here. I note that Kate Eads, who is a listener on Twitter, says that she has her pen in hand as she listens to this program, writing down the titles. Of course, you can go on our website and you can get a much more complete list of the titles that we are mentioning. You're going to have a lot to choose from. I want to pick out one book in particular, and I'm going to go back to you, Elizabeth Taylor, for this because you know, I'm of the age that I grew up reading Laura Ingalls Wilder, and I'm sure, you know, we're all familiar with that. And then there was, of course, a TV show based on that. Tell us about this book that appears as number four on your list, Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls.
I just love this book. It's a fantastic biography. I'm so glad you mentioned it. It is a biography of Laura Ingalls Wilder, but it's really also the story of the West and of how those little house books were made. Because it ties in Laura Ingalls Wilder, who really started writing the books as an adult, as a grown woman, but her daughter, Rose, was really crucial to the books being published and the books being written. And so Caroline Fraser does an amazing job, and she was edited the Library of America editions of the Little House books. So she's sort of the world's expert on Laura Ingalls Wilder. But she depicts Rose as the sort of angry, depressive, you know, woman who sort of wants her mother to, you know, write these books and make money. But and then she is, Rose is overspending money herself. And the two women are competing, and the mother and daughter. And it's just, so it's a mother-daughter story. It's a story of the American West. And you'll sort of never read those story about Laura Ingalls Wilder again. This, you know, they're fantastic.
And you said that you found reading this book that it was both exhilarating and disconcerting.
Yes, because there is a whole sort of a right wing thread running through them. You know, we understand sort of prairie sort of self reliance, but you know, particularly Rose takes it far beyond that. They were very opposed to both Rose and Laura were mother and daughter were opposed to the New Deal. They were a champion of Ayn Rand. Rose was anti-Semitic. So there's a dark side. So
a dark side to those stories that were so on the surface kind of happy and bucolic, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, thank you very much. Elizabeth Taylor is co-editor of the National Book Review, literary editor-at-large for the Chicago Tribune, and a board member and past president of the National Book Critics Circle. We appreciate your time today with us, Elizabeth.
Thanks so much.
Also, Kevin Nguyen, senior editor for GQ, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Betsy Burton, co-owner and co-founder of the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City, Utah, glad to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
You can continue this conversation and you can get the On Point podcast at our website. You can also find our guests' 10 best list and the On Point staff picks, what we read this year. That's all at On Point Radio. You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Jelton. This is On Point.